Welcome back to Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Vertel.
My name is Aida Osman.
And I have to thank Aida for provoking a conversation.
Here we go.
With my father, Lee Vertel. I'm Louis Vertel. He's Lee Vertel.
I'm going to need that explanation very soon. The pronunciation.
Oh, Aida, you missed the entire point when Louis revealed that his entire last name was a lie.
Yes, right.
Oh, you fancied it up for the people.
That's right.
It's pronounced Vertel.
Oh, my God.
He changed it so he could get a job. He didn't want to be discriminated against.
Well, you kind of went, well, why didn't you go full like Louis Vertel?
Well, that's the one white. I'm not French.
I got you.
So
okay.
It didn't seem right.
Okay.
But last week, my dad texted me, Louis, what does au fait mean? And I had to explain to him that the term au fait, which you used in reference to Tina Fey
last week, which still holds, which is
like an old term for cracker, basically.
I cannot believe.
Yes.
I'm happy that. Well, how did he feel? Was he offended?
No. I mean, like, I think it was more like he was wondering if it was a reference to a character or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, tell Lee I will never call him an au fait unless he has au fait behaviors. And that's all I have to say.
At this point, I think he's aware, but who's
okay,
to
good.
Say?
Yeah. Mm. Lee Vertel. Wow.
They're going to change Uncle Ben Rice to Uncle au fait.
Uncle au fait's rice.
That'll make it better.
And it has no flavor packet that comes with it. It's just the white rice.
Just the white rice. Is there a seasoning packet in this? No.
It's like shaking the box and nothing comes out. Just the rice.
And you cook it in the microwave, not on the stove.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it calls you the N-word.
Yeah.
We all learned, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also sure we taught some listeners who did not bother to go and Google au fait.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Oh, definitely not. And I there's been more blackface news, which I'm sure we'll get into later, so that'll be a fun conversation.
Oh, we certainly will.
Good.
Blackface is now like a section of the newspaper. Like, oh, turn to the style section, the blackface component.
Between B and C. Right in between B and C, there's blackface.
I actually think it's a tag on the Federalist.
I used to work at a, years and years ago, I used to work at a website where the woman who founded it, who was this kind of Romanoff looking woman who literally always wore furs and hats like she was in Murder on the Orient Express all the time. Her son is one of the creators of the Federalist, or one of like the main editors.
Oh, wow.
Or something. Anyway, at the time I didn't know really what that was. And now since then I'm only gaining in horror as the years go by. So it's very exciting.
Speaking of exciting, this is our Pride wrap-up episode.
Ugh.
No more gay shit on the show after
this. We can get right back to shame because we're on the clock.
But we have two very exciting guests this week. We will be joined by Olympic skater Adam Rippon.
Olympic.
And hero, yes.
Truly.
Yes.
He's on our fucking Keep It wall. One of the few men on our Keep It wall.
Right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, men are not allowed. I still don't know how Rami Malek is on there.
Yeah. I'm so sad that when I close my eyes, I can't even remember the Keep It wall. It's been that long.
I know. I feel like pure shit. Just want her back.
I'd be like...
I noticed.
Wait, there is another man on the Keep. Oh, Prince is on the wall.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we will also be joined this week by Laomi Judge on HBO Max's legendary all-around icon.
Oh, and the soul of that show, America's Best Dance Crew icon.
Yeah.
One of a kind.
Vogue Evolution.
I pray to Laomi's altar. Are you kidding me?
That's history, love.
I loved Mario Lopez explaining that group every week. He's like, can this niche group turn it out? Like, thanks for contextualizing voguing for me, Mario.
We'll be right back with more Keep It. Like how I did that, like a commercial, y'all.
Yeah, the inflection was nice, Ira. Nice.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll be right back with more Keep It. In case you missed it, we did a Keep It bonus episode over the weekend in collaboration with HBO's Human by Orientation. Available now through the end of July, you can find our episode as well as performances by the cast of HBO's We're Here, Shangela, Bob the Drag Queen, and Eureka. Kim Petras, Janelle Monae, Cameron Esposito, and more at humanbyorientation.com. You'll hear a segment from the special a little later in the episode. Well, Pride Month is drawing to a close, and
thank God.
Arizona just decided its water park should be too, and LA may be closing back up as well.
I would like to congratulate LA for entering phase one. We did it. Wow. 5 months in or whatever, we are figuring it out.
LA has been like inviting your friends to a thing, and then like you're realizing like, oh, you got the date wrong, or the bar is closed, or you didn't actually get the concert tickets, and you're like, sorry, we got to do it later.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Everything is pointless, and I keep forgetting that we are in what we're in, because I'll drive somewhere, and then the grocery store will be closed early, or things will be, it's just, guys, I don't know.
We really were self-congratulatory for a long time. Just, yeah. It seemed like we were ahead of the curve. The virus doesn't spread normally here. Mm-hmm. You know, we were like an advanced species or something, and then it turned out we were just late to the party.
Yes.
No, truly the way that even driving around Los Angeles now, though, feels like nothing happened.
Correct. Yes. Mm-hmm.
The slide back into, you know, like closing down bars again and then probably stay at home orders again is something that's going to have to really be like a massive order coming from Garcetti mm-hmm. or Governor Newsom, just because you go to the grocery store, you go out, and like people are just not wearing masks in the street.
Maskless. Utterly maskless.
It's become a culture war whether or not you should be wearing a mask, which is insane to me.
I'm very interested in this new group of people who suddenly have ailments that require that they cannot wear masks. I'm like, where did this sickness come from?
Yes. White Pop people up. Can't breathe now, too.
Ira, can you guess the only mask battle that I think is worth waging?
Does it involve Cameron Diaz and Jim Carrey?
No, you're getting there.
I was like, I thought it was maybe a critique on the mask singer, but I feel like you're beyond this.
I'm still within it, but you're right, I should be beyond that.
Okay, okay.
It is that Cher deserved a Best Actress nomination for the movie Mask, which didn't happen at the time. See?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I like that. I like that there's always a thread of Oscar that's going to come out of you, no matter what.
It's a sickness. That's correct. It can't be solved. You should always count on it.
Yeah.
Eric Stoltz is one 4-star movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Hey, let's settle down. Let's settle down.
Well, that's the culture in Los Angeles, but what did we get into this week in terms of culture we consumed?
Shall I kick it off?
Go ahead.
With something fun? We rarely get news like this in time for Keep It. And naturally, it's bad news, but the great Carl Reiner died this week. He was a trillion years old, but...
I'm so sorry for laughing. I'm so sorry. Yeah. But carry on.
Yeah. I always feel bad when a celebrity that I adore does die, but I saw maybe 2 or 3 tweets this morning where they were like, oh, unexpected. This hit really hard. I'm like, do you know how old that man was?
He was 88, I think. Maybe
98.
What?
Like, see, my great-grandmother is still alive, and she's like 96, 97. When she goes, it will not be a shock. Could have happened this morning.
If you don't start preparing at age 70, like, it's just a clock. It's waiting. It's counting down at that point.
70, Aida? At least
for other people. I mean,
Jane Fonda's in her 70s. Chill out.
But it's inevitable still.
I mean, sincerely, his adult son has been a sitcom star for 50 years.
Yes.
Carl Reiner was one of those legendary comedy writers at first. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show. Yeah. He directed a whole string of Steve Martin's most famous comedies, including All of Me, which I just saw again recently. Fabulous, stars Lily Tomlin and Steve Martin. And the credit sequence at the end is like the most life-affirming thing you will see all quarantine. I recommend watching that. I think it's on HBO Max right now. But Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Jerk. He released a bunch of comedy albums with his best friend Mel Brooks. They had a whole sketch, The 2,000-Year-Old Man, that they would still do in their spare time because they had dinner together every night and watched Jeopardy every night together. And just like 2 days ago, Carl Reiner was tweeting a tribute to Noel Coward. Watching Jeopardy every night and tweeting about Noel Coward, bitch, this is how I'm going to go out. So I'm glad I have a fucking blueprint for when I'm 90-something.
That's gossip.
See, there it is.
That's sad.
Speaking of their hanging out, Alex Papademos, journalist who I used to work for at MTV News, tweeted out an interaction between Brooks and Reiner in an interview. And it was asking them about them watching TV together. Mel Brooks said that, like, almost every night he's got a wonderful housekeeper and cook, and we decide on a menu and a movie. And when asked what they watched recently, Mel Brooks said they watched The Peacemaker with Nicole Kidman and George Clooney. And Mel Brooks is like, it's 2.5 stars at most. Good performances, very silly, you know. And Carl Reiner says, we look for movies with the line, secure the perimeter.
Yes.
And Brooks follows up with, yeah, we like movies that say secure the perimeter and or you better get some rest.
Oh my God, that is so shockingly, that's so funny. So I'm thinking about Carl Reiner. And by the way, the Dick Van Dyke Show still holds up. And he eventually became a cast member on that show. He played the host of the show Dick Van Dyke wrote for. And by the way, Dick Van Dyke's still with us.
I love the Dick Van Dyke Show.
So yeah, cherish these legends as we still have them.
That was one of the shows that I watched nightly, just because of Nick at Night TV Land. It is weird to think of it now in the concept of what the youth are watching, making myself sound old. But truly, when we were younger, Nick at Night TV Land had like Dick Van Dyke and Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. And so it was like you were introduced to these classic sitcoms every night in a way that you aren't now, you know?
Like, no.
You pull up streaming and you go look for The Office or whatever you remember was on TV like a few years ago, you know? Like, if you didn't see Eight Simple Rules for Dating My Teenage Daughter, you're not going to go hunting for it.
No, no kidding. We're like the last generation that would learn about TV that was more than 20 years older than my birthday, you know? So, and by the way, I just want to stick my neck out for Bewitched, too. Totally funny, totally holds up.
Hilarious. Even Three's Company was one of my favorite shows that my mom would let me watch with her as a child, and I, to this day, don't think anyone else will watch it beyond us, and it is hilarious. Hilarity.
I called a friend with new curly hair in the quarantine and a mustache. I referred to him as Mr. Cotter and looked at me like I was crazy.
See?
New curly hair.
But I mean, what you're saying is people don't even know John Travolta's origins anymore. I mean, he's still an active player in our lives. Come on.
Also, Aida, you may know Carl Reiner from the Ocean's movies. He played Saul.
Oh, well, then my condolences to the Reiner family.
Oh, now we got her.
Now
we got her.
Now I'm here. Okay, I did notice today. I did notice did you guys see that Kanye West has penned that 10-year deal with Gap, which I have to laugh at for multiple reasons. One, we talked about this before, think they're going to make $1 billion a year off of this deal over at the Gap. It's going to be Yeezy Gap. And also, for any Kanye fans from the College Dropout album, he has a whole track where he talks about working at the Gap. And
bet you they're going to show off their token Blackie.
Yes, exactly.
He compared it to a slave shift. Okay.
Like. And the first verse, he says that he shoplifted continuously and incessantly from the Gap. And in the second one, he critiques the Gap for tokenizing him. And now look at him. And that's why I was saying this is the most Kanye shit I've ever seen, where somehow he's held this evil, vengeful spirit for the Gap so much so that he's going to just take all their money.
In a way, I'm almost proud of that. But at the same time, it's Kanye. So, of course, I'm glowering.
Yeah. And also, the clothes are going to be like H&M with some neon in them. It's going to be like, go ahead, girl, give us nothing. Give us absolutely nothing once again.
I think it's clownery. Here's my thing. This goes to an issue that I've long had with Kanye West, that I will consider what some Black people will see as progress, yes? And that is access to a white space and not really changing anything within that white space. We've seen Kanye with this before in the fashion industry, right? You know, where he used to constantly get mad about how his designs weren't taken seriously, you know, by like other houses and, you know, within Fashion Week, etc. And it was never really that he wanted an entryway for black people into the fashion industry. He just wanted an entryway for himself mm-hmm. into the fashion industry, you know? That is the whole reasoning behind his friendship with Donald Trump in the first place, you know? Wherever that is now, I guess now Trump is more friends with Kimberly. but that whole thing was just about, like, exceptionalism for himself, for the individual, yes? And this Gap thing seems more like it, too. I mean, you talked about being a token black person at the Gap. You talked about shoplifting, as you said. You, like, compared working the graveyard shift, overnight shift there to slavery, mm-hmm. You know, on Spaceship, on the College Dropout. And now you have a partnership with the Gap, so... Is it okay for other niggas to steal
right? Yeezys exactly.
from the Gap? Will they in turn have the token black person who works there now selling your shit, right? So, like, are you going in and changing management within the Gap, or is mm-hmm. this just about some itch you've had to be respected by the people who you felt disrespected you at one point, you know, which is sort of Kanye's ethos, you know? I mean, I feel like that's all... Last Call on College Dropout is about, you know, and that's all about his Big Brother song with Jay-Z, you know, like that whole mentality was about besting the people who underestimated you. I did not tweet a full drag of the Gap thing, you know, because I mean, it would have been like something, something. Can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house, etc.
Wow, it's so nice to get this behind-the-scenes glimpse into a tweet of yours.
Truly, the entering Iris drafts.
I'm like, look at me tweeting that while going to cash a check from NBC Universal, talking about the master's house. Anyway.
When I was in college, I had, or I think maybe high school, I had a green terry cloth shirt with like little almost cap sleeves, you know,
oh, so
you know
you've
how gay...
always been this. Okay.
Yeah. I mean like, you know, right. You know how gay people looked in like 2004. it's just funny to picture Kanye West probably having to wear that shirt, right? Like, cause those people would stand out in front of the store wearing a shirt from the store. Anyway, funny image. Kelly Green.
I worked at the Gap, Lewis, in Chicago.
You did?
Oh yeah.
On Michigan Avenue. Michigan
you know
Avenue.
What? Might've been the same one that Kanye worked at. I wouldn't be too shocked. Look at you.
I don't know if he worked at the Michigan Avenue one, but I worked at that one. And Oprah definitely came there during her red campaign.
Mm. Oh, right. Yeah. Was the red campaign also the, like, U2? And,
yeah,
everything was red and had the word red in parentheses on the shirt. And it's like, I'm not, like, a billboard for you, Bono. Like, I don't know how I feel about having to wear that, but okay.
Yeah. Something that really impressed me this weekend was the BET Awards on Sunday.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
You know, I... love watching the BET Awards because at this point they are more fun than the VMAs. I wouldn't say they usually are. Like the BET Awards sometimes used to be a mess. But in recent years, they've really, really been entertaining and really felt like they are still one of the like last bastions of popular black culture in music and entertainment.
Yeah.
Definitely loved the feel of the award show on Sunday. It was hosted by Amanda Seales, everyone's fave. And, you know, she hosted it from her home with a green screen. Mm-hmm. And what I loved is that all the performances were filmed, you know, like outside of a studio, you know, they weren't typical live performances. And how they pulled this off, I don't know.
I don't get it.
It is better. Honestly,
100%
than what you would get before, because first of all, Megan Thee Stallion's performance was fucking amazing. She did her new song, "Girls in the Hood," that Eazy-E sample, and it was like this Mad Max performance. And then she shifted into Savage, and it was just like dancing on platforms, and it looked
flawless.
Like it was beyond Stallion Dome. I was like, okay, where's the new Mad Max? Where she can do a cover or like a song that samples "We Don't Need Another Hero." I need it.
Right.
Exactly. And what's amazing about this is we're watching Megan become into her own as a performer. Like she was dancing a lot prior, but now she's doing full heel toes, full orchestrated choreography. Like it looks absolutely amazing. And More power to her. It was beautiful. I'm sliding off the chair thinking about it. So
that performance was fabulous. And you're right. And like, it was way more production value than you would probably get from an award show. So it was this strange, like, should we not go back to that thing?
Right.
Right.
Well, you know what? One performance I could have done without, and you guys know how I feel about Jonathan, Mr. DaBaby. Please. He did an entire song while he recreated the imagery of George Floyd's death with a white police officer kneeling on his neck while he rapped the first verse of a song. And I personally hated it. Hated every second of that. I don't really see the value right now in him recreating that for a award show that is watched primarily by black people. Do you understand? And I feel like if this were a different situation, if he was doing it for the Grammys, maybe that'd be a conversation worth having. But for this, it felt insensitive.
Trauma that we didn't need to revisit.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's trauma that he didn't get cleared by the family.
Yeah, it's not a smart analysis of trauma, right? It's very base, you know? Leave that to Michaela Cole, all right?
I just started watching that. I'm loving her so far.
Girl,
I mean, about talking about this show every time a new episode drops. Like, I have to stop myself from talking about it on Keep It. It's so amazing.
I have started watching the episodes that have aired in the UK, so I'm so much further along.
You didn't see my tweet. I subtweeted you. I don't know if you saw it.
What did you tweet?
I tweeted. I was like, how do Ira be getting the episodes before me? I hate this nigga, bro. I didn't see it. No response.
You didn't at me.
I was like, who does this nigga know? Like, where is he getting this stuff? So spill your little secrets if you may.
I'll send you the link.
Okay, girl.
Yes. Yes. Underground Railroad this shit.
Thank you. This is black activism right here.
But speaking of Megan coming into her own, I would just also lastly say that COVID and having to do these performances at home or in different spaces has really brought out a lot in some artists. And I would say another artist at the BET Awards was Chloe and Halle.
They are the queens of this.
It is so wild to me that in less than a year, they have churned out what I would call so many iconic performances. And these are performances that, when we're all just like gays hanging out like we do, Lewis, and we're like drinking and watching music videos at a friend's house, you know, you'll be like, oh, pull up these Britney videos, pull up these Beyonce videos or whatever. And like the live performances, they're always like, oh, this one happened this year, that one happened next year, etc. The amount that they have produced just within the past few weeks is wild. And a wealth.
It seems like they're producing for exactly that kind of viewing experience, too. Like, people want to gather around a music video. It's something you want to see again and again and again. And the eye-popping visuals, always, like, so brightly colored. Like, their synchronicity, you know, just so rad. And you like that album way more than I do. I think it's, like, an okay album, but they are awesome.
I think Ungodly Hour is great, yeah.
Yeah, I really love the album. I really think that their coming albums, as they start to age and start to mature together, are going to be amazing. Right now, it's still not in my field of enjoyment. However, I don't know, were you guys following Chloe and Halle like the beginning when they were making YouTube videos, Little Chillin's?
Yeah, it wasn't for me.
I'm sure.
Now I like their legal drinking age bops.
Yes. So, they're getting dirty.
Yes.
I like that they swear. Yeah.
You tap that explicit lyrics label on an album and I am there.
Yeah. Parental guidance.
Lil' Kim hardcore, etc. Yes.
It is still truly a nightmare when you accidentally click on the album on Spotify that doesn't have the explicit lyrics, like it's the edited version, and it would remind me when I would accidentally buy the edited version at like a Sam Goody.
Oh, truly. Yes. No, that happens to me every once in a while. I'll have downloaded something and it's like, oh no, but I want the version with the mean PJ Harvey or whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, once again, the BET Awards were just really fantastic this year, and that DaBaby performance aside, it really felt like it was speaking to black people about what's going on, and that was nice to sit down and watch something that felt like it wasn't being filtered through. White people are watching this, so we gotta give them a reading list, and we gotta make sure we don't like get too angry, you know.
And Beyonce looking more and more like her Madame Tussaud wax figure every week.
Yes.
Just way too perfect, way too good, way too beautiful.
It's so weird to be 1 month ahead of a project we know is coming out from her. Like, wow, I'm anticipating something as opposed to just waiting for her to like throw it at me.
All right. We'll be right back with Adam Rippon.
Hey, it's Tommy from Pod Save America and Pod Save the World. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics to talk about how to fix this mess. Even President Obama made a surprise appearance. We're doing it all again November 5th to 7th in Washington, D.C., with even more podcasts, panels, and workshops. Plus, there'll be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get tickets at CrookedCon.com. If you're a friend of the pod, you get a discount too. See you there.
After skating his way into our hearts and Mike Pence's nightmares during the 2018 Winter Olympic Games in Pyeongchang, our first guest has won Dancing with the Stars and currently hosts the Quibi show, This Day in Useless Celebrity History. Please welcome Adam Rippon.
What an entrance. Hello. Hi, everybody.
That intro had it all.
it truly did. If I could think of all of the intros I've ever gotten, this is absolutely top three.
Good.
Thank you for ranking those for us. Mm-hmm. Adam, you are on, we talked about this earlier, in our studio when we record in our studio. Mm-hmm. This was decades ago at this point.
Right. But is this not the studio?
No, we have a wall full of like celebs we like, and there are only three men on them, and you are one of them. So congrats to you.
Yeah.
I am welling up right now.
Get close. I want to see the eyes to the camera so I can see. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah. A bit dewy. Lewis, but I do have to tell you that you are a big reason of why I'm gay.
You think so?
Yeah, I do want to say that it was like a turning point of watching like social voguing on...
verbal voguing.
Verbal
yes,
voguing, right. Sorry.
It was social in a way.
Okay, yeah. Hey everyone, I had a great time. I gotta go.
Anti-social voguing.
It was anti-social voguing. But yeah, I had no idea what you were saying because I'm stupid. But I was like... I think I'm like that. And
oh my God, I'm terribly flattered.
That's
well, also,
so beautiful.
Well, before you were in the Olympics, I followed you on Twitter. And what I noticed about you was it wasn't just like you were a little bit funny in the way that we give celebrities credit for being funny. Mm. It was you had a whole sensibility about yourself that was like not just sassy, it was like, humor was clearly a part of your everyday, every moment experience.
Yeah.
And my thing is, though, that was never initially part of your job description. You were obviously an Olympian. My question is, why are you funny? Like, why are you this funny? It's very strange to me.
To everyone around me as well. I think growing up, I always used humor as like a coping mechanism. And I always dreamed of like going in and being involved in comedy somehow, but like I had no idea. Like, how the fuck was I gonna do that? I was trying to, the only thing, my biggest focus was being as thin as possible and beating teenagers. So that was my main focus. Still is, obviously.
Right.
I can't lose my focus. But it was I always used it to like distract myself from being nervous and whatever. And then by the time I was like skating my best, I wasn't never going to win anything. I was going to be a really good teammate and I was a really good athlete, but I was never going to be like, oh, you might get, like, I remember like even at the Olympics, like Savannah Guthrie, like God bless her soul, and trying to do her own makeup on Zoom for her, you know, NBC right now too. So we're having a full moment for her. She's really trying to just do her own BB cream at home. And I remember that like I had just skated, there were like 10 more people to go. This was after I won a medal for in our team event. So like there's 10 more people to go. She's like, what would it mean to like get one more medal? And I was like, Savannah, let's not do this on TV. And she's like, no, be serious with me. Like, wouldn't it be amazing? I'm like, if I got one more medal, it would mean that something terrible happens to the next 10 skaters. Like the building will be on fire or something like that. And she's like, okay, back to you, Hoda. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, like, what do you want me to say? But I've always loved, and I'm one of six kids. So it was always competing for like attention and who can make everyone laugh. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of even just that interview, I think you're like our first athlete on Keep It.
Is that true?
I think so.
Yes.
And 100%. I consider our first Olympic athlete.
I consider Easily. Jane Fonda an athlete. So you can leave that out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Sprinting over cop cars. It was definitely in the Olympics at one point.
I think the original ones in Greece.
That's right. Yes.
But that Savannah interaction you described reminds me of a thing that I've literally always wanted to ask athletes. What is that like? You are literally giving your physical best and like straining yourself emotionally, mentally in a competition, and then you're done. And there's a reporter like right there asking like, well, how did that go? And like, what else do you want to have? And like, every time I watch like a basketball game or like the Super Bowl ends, it's like, well, what do you think you're going to do to win? And it's like, that just seems like the basis thing to try and answer in that moment.
The whole pageantry of doing interviews is like part of being an athlete. That like, you know that you have them before events, you know that like you have them immediately after, like there's beads of sweat and you're like, it was amazing, like I can grow from this. But before is where the true, like that's where the true showmanship comes, because I lied about jumps that I could do. I lied about how practice was going. Like I would literally be coming from like a mental breakdown from the bathroom, dry my eyes, get into my car outside of the rink, which is next to a Taco Bell. And I would just sit in the car and they'd be like, how's everything going? And I'd be like, you know, like sniffle, sniffle, like, yeah, I've never felt better.
God, good Lord, what could be worse?
Yeah, it's just, especially in skating, because like it's one, it's individual, and there's this like entertainment value to it as well, mm-hmm. that like everyone has some sort of opinion. And I think like when I got older, I felt like I could be more in on the joke of like all of this like kind of craziness that surrounds all of these questions and everything. And I think of that now being out of it for, I guess, almost 3 years at this point, but like 2.5. I'm no math wizard. just being out of it, I see like how insane it is. But yeah, I mean, it's just part of it. You know, you get off the ice, blot, blot, and then you just start answering questions. It's just like, it's part of the pageant. Like all sports are the circus without animals.
You know, it was a beautiful moment that you and Lewis just had when you said that you saw yourself in Lewis and the way that he was as a gay man, as a funny gay man. Lewis, don't take that too. I don't want you to think that about you.
I truly did. I mean, you know that episode of Family Guy where Peter Griffin is like so stupid, but he learns the words like shallow and pedantic, and he like walks.
Oh yes,
that
yes.
was me. Like literally yeah. not having a clue anything that you were talking about, Lewis. Mm-hmm. Still don't. And
it's my honor to be misinterpreted and sort of glanced at by you.
but for you, like, have you experienced since coming out and being open about being gay? That have you received any? I don't know how often you're around the little skating tots, but have you received any thank yous or any good words?
The short answer, yes. The long form is that right immediately after the Olympics, I was on a Stars on Ice tour, so like a skating tour. And we have like a bunch of meet and greets, and the interaction I had that really made me feel like, I guess people did kind of like catch on to my story, was there was this like really young girl. She was cute. She had like her, you know, little denim jacket. She had some rainbow pins on and stuff. I didn't really think anything of it. She was just very nice. And maybe 2 minutes later, her mom came over to me and her mom was crying. And she told me that her daughter was like, had no friends at school. She was very quiet. She wasn't talking to anybody in her family. And then they watched the Olympics together and she saw me skate. And then she had all of these questions about like what being gay was. And she like went down this like rabbit hole of trying to figure it out. And then within like a month or a few weeks after the Olympics, she came out to her family. And she's like, she's been completely, she's like a different girl.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's amazing. Cause truly, like, I came out cause I didn't give a fuck. And, and I wasn't like, I'm gonna change the world. I was like, I'm gonna piss people off. And so.
While that is an awesome story, I mean, like, you must hear things like that a lot. And that would be incredibly overwhelming to me. I mean, just how do you sit with all these stories? Because you're somebody who, when you appear on TV in whatever form, Dancing in the Stars, the Olympics, whatever, my reaction would not be, I have questions about gayness. It's, oh, here are all the answers about gayness, you know? So is it like to take on the emotional weight of all these people who are seeing probably something they've never seen before in certain parts of the country? Is that like draining?
I think that it's all within our own like realm of perspective of like it's taking them one on one, not so much being like, I, you know, I don't have the weight of the world on my shoulders. But like if I'm like talking to someone one on one, I really feel like I can connect with someone. Even people like will message me on Instagram or something. And they'll just, if they write something that's like pretty heartfelt, I always feel compelled to like write something just as heartfelt back. And what I mean by that is when someone just writes to me, hey, and I'm like, I should write a, I should a truly back. Write a novel. Yeah. but I think that, there obviously was like, there were less eyes on me before Olympics and after it's, there are more, but, I think that I just try to do everything for the same reasons I did anything before. Cause if I really like it, you know, I might say things that are like off the cuff, but I don't ever say anything that I don't like think about. And I think that's just the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even just speaking of like the draining point of, having fans looking up to you, you know? I mean, like, you also have to deal with just, like, this being the one, like, gay person, you know? Like, mm-hmm. having this lightning rod of, like, politicians, you know? Or, like, evil Russian skaters, you know?
Sure.
You know, constantly just, like, using you as the person to spew hatred at. How do you reconcile, you know, with the fact that, like, I guess I'm the person who has to deal with this.
When I look in the mirror, I like can look back and be like, of course you're the person that's getting spewed at. And like, and yeah, and I can take it. Like, and then but if I start to think like any, especially like within my sport, like I think that a lot of people don't have like a really thick skin and it really doesn't. Yeah, it hurts for a second, but at the end of the day, I truly, it does. If I'm doing things for the right reasons, like I said before, like I'm not bothered if somebody doesn't agree with those. When I was at the Olympics and it was sort of, really amplified, you do live in like a bubble when you're there because you just don't like have the true idea of like what's going on. But when I was there and it was just, everything was like blowing up, like I couldn't open any of like Instagram or Twitter or anything because they were just like lock up because it was just like I was getting so many followers and so many people were writing at me and which was, you know, kind of surreal. But I just reminded myself that like all of that was just like in this little box, which was my phone. Like that wasn't real world. Like my real world was that I was living in like a 3-bedroom apartment in Korea with 5 other people who were having nervous diarrhea. Like that was my real world. And so that's what I focused on there.
I mean, I'm sorry that most of the messages that came to you were from my best friend's mom, Sally Fields.
So, oh, right. I forgot all about that. Yes. Oh. She and her goddamn son, our friend, may have crowded your timeline a bit.
I know. I mean, like everything during that time, I think because it was, I mean, everything was like so surreal. It was like Sally Field was tried to set me up with Sam. And then within the same breath, it was like Britney Spears was like, I really hope you do well. And I was like, I hope you're doing well. It was just, like, bizarre. It was, like, anything could happen. And then, like, I remember one of the things that I was, like, this is so, like, everything going on right now is so funny where it was, like, I think it was just because it was a political thing to say that, like, it was, like, Hillary Clinton wishes Adam Ripon luck at the Olympics. It was, like, an article on The Hill. And I was, like, okay.
So what is life looking like for you now? I mean, I imagine dancing and skating is a huge outlet for you. And if we're living in a type of confinement, where are you getting out? I imagine also that you have a larger awareness, athletes especially, awareness of your body than I do. Like, I can't really feel my toes right now. So I just want to know, like, how is it for you? Where are you working out? Where are you dancing?
Here's the thing. We aren't that different. I can't feel anything from the knee down. And I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to either. I think, like, skating has become, like, an outlet for me. But I think the biggest thing is, like, when you're an athlete, you're so used to, like, being physically exhausted at the end of the day. Like, your body hurts. You've exerted so much energy, and that I think what I do now, which is mostly just like comedy stuff or like writing and things like that, that it's mentally draining, but it's not the same sort of exhaustion that you feel when you've like physically exerted yourself, and that you still have like energy is a very weird thing. And I'm still sort of like kind of trying to cleanse myself from feeling that like needing those endorphins to like pump so intensely. But every time I can get to the rink, it's always just like, it'll always feel like home. I think for like when I was retiring, it was a little bit bizarre because I couldn't skate without like training, like I was trying to go to the Olympics. But ever since I've gained like 30 pounds since the Olympics, it's been a lot easier not to train that way.
And now, by the way, you are hosting my dream project, which is called This Day in Useless Celebrity History. First of all, you are definitely taking a job away from me with this project. I just want to say, specific to me, I'm angry. Even a cursory look of what you've done on YouTube and stuff, you've had videos about celebrities and like lots of celebrity humor. How did this project come to be, and why are you seemingly so obsessed with pop culture?
Well, I've always loved pop culture because it's like my Tolstoy. It's, you know... because it seems also surreal. It's like the pageantry of celebrity and all of that it's so like fascinating to me. But more than anything, I love to commentate on things, and I love to just, my dream job, I think, is to like be able to like sit down and talk and basically like shoot the shit with someone. But this project was the first time that I was actually able to like get and sit into like a writer's room and like write jokes with everybody, and it was so much fun, and it was something that I was like, I'm so like grateful and lucky to do.
But just to be clear, on the show, which I haven't seen yet, it's not out yet, is
careful, all of everybody's Quibi subscription is ending soon.
There we are. But like Lindsay Lohan is on this, correct?
Yeah. Oh my God. Can we take a, first of all, I just want a moment of silence for Lindsay Lohan being in Dubai, because we did this. We basically to, you know, the magic of show business, we sent her questions and I recorded me asking them to her, and then we made them look like a Zoom call. Spoiler alert.
Got it.
But she is on the show. So we asked her a bunch of questions, and it was truly like a case study in someone looking good, looking really good. She looked hydrated. She had at least, you know, she had her 32 ounces of water. I don't know if she drank it or if she just, you know, used it in the shower or whatever, but she was...
The water interacted with her.
Yes. The elements were, you know, somewhere around her. So she's a fascinating being. Truly, she's very fascinating. So it was just like listening to her answer these questions. It was like, I've never seen anyone literally do gymnastics around like, hey, how's it going in Dubai? Giving me basically 10 minutes of how it was going in Dubai. Instead of just good. It was truly like, well, you know, and she does have that like slight accent, which, where is that from? Let me travel there. Let me have that.
Every 15 years or so, we do need a celebrity with a mystery accent. You know, like it was used to be Madonna, and then it was like Gwyneth, and now it's Lindsay.
Yeah. It is Lindsay. I really hope someone gets some sort of mystery Australian accent. That is my, it's all, because it's always some sort of, it seems, it's seemingly a suburb outside of like Cambridge. And it's like, it's always sort of like England inspired. I really want someone to go down under.
Oh, Australian has become the resident like gay accent. It's the one we care the most about. You know, if you want to like set my endorphins on fire, you play a Jackie Weaver interview. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Or something from Darling Nay.
Yes. Darling Nay is a reference to Naomi Watts. Yes.
Thank you so much for being here, Anna.
It's so my pleasure. You guys are so fantastic. I'm so happy to be here today.
Yeah.
Among human beings I have met or will ever meet, you are one of the slays of all time. So thanks so much for being Adam Rippon.
Well, I hope I can come into the studio one day and see my photo.
Yes, you're the third person from the wall to be on the show. So, you know,
congrats.
We've had Jane and Angela Bassett.
Some say I was the Angela Bassett of figure skating, so that checks out.
Debbie Thomas has words. Yeah.
Well, I love you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Coming up next, a special Pride segment. Listen, we could spend our time talking about how Terry Crews is an idiot who keeps tweeting about how he doesn't understand the Black Lives Matter movement and thinks black supremacy is a thing. But instead, Louis Aida and I collaborated with HBO's Human by Orientation for their Pride stream. We wanted to share a snippet of that conversation where we talk about Pulse, the importance of the community coming together, and our favorite Pride moments. So enjoy this clip, and happy Pride.
You know, feel like I would obviously be taking part in Pride with a lot of my friends right now, and that is one thing that I do miss. The community of Pride has felt like it has vanished a bit in the midst of COVID. And that's one thing I do like, just because of when I worked at MTV News a few years back, I wrote a piece on the first Pride after the Pulse nightclub shooting. And, that one in Los Angeles felt a little sort of similar to the one that was the march that ended with everyone there, right? You know, it was sort of somber, but it was also sort of hopeful and felt like a little defiant in a way. And it's unfortunate that these things have all been happening one after the other, and truly a progression of where this country, unfortunately, is politically moving with a lot of hatred going on. But that Pride reminded me a lot of that Pride in 2016.
Yeah.
When Pulse happened, obviously it was perpetrated on the queer community, but hearing news like that, no matter who you're around, is incredibly isolating, and you're wondering, you know, why you feel so unsafe, and you know, whether me, I'm like a you know, generally speaking, a privileged person who gets to do what he wants in life, like how much homophobia I've ignored due to convenience, and actually reuniting with, you know, a community and centering our anger somewhere and realizing you're not alone has been not just helpful, but like, I'm so thankful for it. I'm so thankful people are ready to organize and galvanize so loudly and so effectively. And I feel like LA has done a lot of that.
Yeah, and especially, you know, to go back to the 2016 of it and the way this came again, the Black Lives Matter kind of coincided with everything that's going on, and it kind of adds to my fear that I've been having of going outside, and the fear that I had 4 years ago after the Pulse shooting about existing and being loud and being gay and being queer and out. But it reminds me the importance and, the longevity, hopefully, of the internet and the ability for us to have these moments and have these conversations in a very out and loud way without having to deal with the physical implications that might happen if we step outside the house. So, you know, it's a thing to balance out, but I feel very fortunate.
Also, just a reminder that we should be living in these moments, right? You know, like it is fearful to step outside the house, but we're grateful for the people that do, you know, and we're even seeing that in protest. You know, like the people who are making themselves most visible are the people who we end up getting to thank for the community at large being able to be visible, you know, and I think if anything, this Pride was really sort of reminding a lot of people that, as I said before, you know, a lot of visibly trans people of color, Black trans women, Latinx trans women have been out there on the front lines, and they are the ones who are most visible and sort of face a lot of the violence in our community. And I think that, if anything, it told us that, you know, we may be afraid to be leaving our home right now, but they're always afraid. And we should be showing up more and being more visible in spaces to protect them.
Yeah, you can't underestimate the power of, this is like a cliche phrase now, but like putting your body on the line in certain ways, you know, by existing, it feels like people are just doing that. But in, like, to channel it specifically and to like get your community and people, get your friends into it and to show up is just important. It's a version of doing something. It's the beginning of a movement, but it's doing something.
Absolutely.
Sorry, to support those people and then getting creative yourself if you are at home and figuring out how you can help. Be gay in the comfort of your own home.
Right. And that has involved, you know, like opening your purse. you know, if you have that privilege to donate money to specific charities that help trans women of color, you know, even if it's things with just helping people with housing, you know, helping people with gender reassignment surgeries, you know, it's things like that that are big, monumental help in people's lives that is just a small thing to you, no matter how much you can donate.
Also, looking up the places you can donate is a weird cheat to learn about experiences you otherwise wouldn't have known about. Like when you are, you know, look up like effective places to donate for like at-risk Black trans sex workers, you then learn about their experience. Like it's a way to get the sort of Wikipedia version of things that we have probably otherwise looked over, you know? So if you're looking to be lazy, almost donate. See? Yeah, I'm helping the laziest among us.
What are some of all of your favorite moments from just like Pride in general? You know, not talking specifically, we talked about Pulse, Pride, that one, we talked about this recent one, but like, you know, what is maybe like a memory you remember from your first Pride?
Well, this has to be about 8 or 9 years ago. I'm 33, I moved to LA when I was 22. The first real Pride I ever experienced was here. So this was maybe my second or third one. I looked forward to Pride because it was an opportunity to hang out with people I like, people I admire, and, you know, not just be politically present, but also, like, celebrate yourselves in the street, right? Like, that alone is worth having an event about. But that year, my mom, who's from, who still lives in the house I grew up in a suburb of Illinois, or a suburb of Chicago, she was in town, and a part of me thought, damn it. Like, I can't just have the normal experience with my friends. I have to do something with my mom, who I love. But I was like, can I incorporate her into this without, like, completely weirding her out, without having to explain everything for her? You know, I come from people who are rad, but deeply wholesome and, like, you know, offended by things like adultery in movies. So, you know, I had no idea how much Pride in LA would need to be explained to her. And she showed up. My friends were like, bring your mom. Like, who cares? Whatever. We'll see how it goes. And she came. That was one of the most fun times I've ever had in LA. Like, to just introduce the idea of Pride and to not just my mom, but introduce myself to the idea that Pride is also such a family environment, actually. There's families all over the place. People bring, like, their kids, their relatives come into town. You know, it's a way to unite with everybody. And my mom got to meet all of my friends in a super celebratory environment. So I look back on that as a triumph that I did not expect, that I was not cool enough to expect.
Yeah. My first Pride experience was the first year of college. I had just dealt with the truth of my life, which was that I was gay. And I had a couple friends that were also queer, and we were trying to figure out how to get to Pride. And how to get to Pride in a city like Lincoln, Nebraska, that doesn't have a flourishing gay community that is also out and proud and willing to march up and down the streets. We do have a Pride, and we did have a Pride in that year. However, my Muslim mother she was not gonna let me go to that. She was not gonna even let me wear what I wanted to wear. The second she saw me wearing rainbow anything, she clocked it and was like, okay, you're not leaving. You're not leaving the house. None of this is happening. And then there was the same situation that kind of happened with my other friends too, who had very pious parents that weren't going to allow them to march and to walk with the Pride parade. So my friends and I all snuck out in the middle of the night, and we went to another friend's basement, and we sat there and just shared our own Pride stories, our own stories about being gay, first time we realized we were queer. And we built that community ourselves in a world where we weren't even allowed to celebrate our queerness. And it was just the most beautiful moment. And then that is the next year we snuck out, and you know, we were smart enough to not wear rainbows, so we didn't have our parents couldn't clock it. And we took our ass over to the parade, and we marched with the six people in Lincoln, Nebraska that was marching with us. So it was a lot of fun.
I hope there were some sexy wheat-based costumes in the Lincoln, Nebraska gay pride parade.
My first one was Chicago, actually. It was, I was an undergrad there at Loyola Chicago, and I had been out, you know, for like a couple of years prior, but it was really a friend who, a friend came out later in college, and he wanted to go to Pride, his first one, and then I sort of realized that I hadn't really gone myself, so I went with him, and that experience, you know, being on Halstead in Chicago was a fun experience, and it was just so foreign for the first time, you know, seeing that many gay people just out, you know, right. seeing gay men, seeing, you know, lesbians, trans people, seeing families there, you know, it was the first time it really felt like being gay was something to me, but beyond just like, oh, this thing that I am that, you know, like sometimes you have to let people know about when they're talking to you, right?
Mm, right. No, when my mom first came to LA, I think I was walking with her down Wilshire, maybe we're going to LACMA or something. She just goes, everybody's just gay here. Like, just like, oh, it's just happening, you know? They're not like special events really anymore.
Coming up next, we talk to the icon, Laomi. Today we are joined by a living legend, the crown jewel of New York ballroom, who first gained national attention on America's Best Dance Crew, and who has since been a choreographer and actress on FX's Pose, currently a judge on Legendary on HBO Max. Please welcome the one and only Laomi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Laomi, this TV show could not be any better. I find every week I'm obsessed with a different judge or a different crew, or I can't believe they brought that, or I can't believe she said that. What has been the most surprising part of the fun of the show for you?
Honestly, for me, the most exciting thing about the show is how people are taking it in. Mm-hmm. I'm loving how much education people are getting from this, how much inspiration people are getting from this, how much hope and just all the love that we're receiving, the community alone, it's so beautiful. I feel like that's the thing that stands out to me the most. Being a part of the show overall for me has been an amazing experience. I would have never thought that after being a part of the ballroom scene for about 17 years that I would end up, you know, being on a show judging this ballroom competition. And it's something that is so surreal.
Mm-hmm. You are the judge to me. You're my favorite judge on the show. I love watching. I didn't even know there was three other ones. I'm just finding out, actually. But I did want to ask you about, I mean, since you are the person that comes from ballroom experience, how much of your judging experience in the beginning of the show was teaching or explaining things to Jameela or Law or Megan Thee Stallion? You know, like, what was that like in the beginning phases?
Well, for me, I love the fact that they were so receptive mm-hmm. to actually learning. And, you know, that's what I'm there for. I'm there to teach them. And I loved how they actually cared to understand. They were asking questions and they were, you know, like, if they had an opinion and I'm like, well, no, that's not what the category is. They would ask me, like, why? You know? And that's something that's important because a lot of people, they come into the ballroom scene and they see these categories and they get so awed by the fact or, you know, just the excitement of it, of the presentation, and they forget what the category is. So mm-hmm. that's something that working with them has been mm-hmm. so easy. It's been so cool. And I love how open they are. Also, it's important to know their opinion as well, because they're there for a reason. They were chosen for a reason. So it's a mix and match kind of thing. I'm mm-hmm. teaching them about, you know, ballroom and stuff, but I'm also learning and also finding ways to see what they're looking for. Mm-hmm.
I read an interview with you recently that I thought was so interesting, because you talked about the difference between what your style of voguing was, which was more about agility and athleticism, compared to what was more in vogue within voguing, which is kind of more about like mm-hmm. feminine posturing and things like that. Can you talk about just how you felt you had to fit into the ballroom scene and what it took to sort of, you know, make a mark? Mm-hmm.
For me, I never felt I needed to fit in the ballroom. And that's something that made me so different from a lot of people who come into ballroom. They come into ballroom with the idea of, oh, I'm going to become legendary. I want to be known. I want to be famous in the ballroom scene. I didn't look at it like that. For me, I fell in love with voguing. It was a way for me to release stress and release the complications that I was going through in my mind and dealing with my own transness, being young and stuff. So I used voguing as a way of like expressing myself. So when I came into the ballroom scene, it was so different to what they were used to. For me, I just educated myself on what voguing was. I found out what creates voguing, which is the five elements of vogue. It's hand performance, catwalk, duck walk, spins and dips, floor performance. So it was all about perfecting these elements, but still staying true to myself and how I allowed the music to incorporate what I wanted to my body to show. And that's something that it was hard, because for a long time they were very shady about it, and I had to battle legends and show them in that way. Like, oh yeah, I can hold down with the mean dog too. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask about you know, being in ballroom back then, and then also having this huge sort of moment being on America's Best Dance Crew, you know, like, what was that like, you know, really sort of putting ballroom and voguing out there in a way that maybe people hadn't seen since, you know, Paris is Burning? You know, I feel like I actually discovered voguing through that show before Paris is Burning. Mm-hmm. And it was such a great introduction to the culture. But watching it back now, you know, I'm like, there are definitely like wild moments of, you know, like Mario Lopez, like explaining like basically what voguing is to like people who don't know who it is. And then like, of course, you know, the uncomfortable like one judging moment, you know, from like Little Mama, you know, where she just completely talks horribly about like what it is being a trans woman, and not in a way we would speak now.
Of course, for me it was tough, because when we went on America's Best Dance Crew, it was solely just to show the world where voguing came from. Mm-hmm. Around that time, you started seeing like my signature hair move, the lolly being shown by all these artists. Then you started seeing the dips being seen in all these videos, and we're like, wait, why aren't we the ones doing it? Mm-hmm. So when we went on America's Best Dance Crew, the first week that we did the first performance, that was kind of something that for us was an eye-opener, because we kind of felt like we were going to be receiving negative energy because of being of color, because being a part of the LGBT community and us being the first ones to be out there. And then for me, being a trans woman, having to be on a platform like that and having to showcase, you know, my life, that was tough for me. But we knew that it was beyond that. The first week that we were on there, we received so much love, mm-hmm. and people were so open about what the ballroom scene was, and that made us feel so proud. Any moment after that really didn't matter. Like, the fact that we made it to the top five, that was a blessing, mm-hmm. but it was that first moment. It was about that impact that we made that first night. And ever since then, I've just been just working hard and just keeping ballroom alive and making sure that I find different ways to incorporate my artistry in ballroom, but also bring it to the mainstream where it's accepted in the art form.
You're also a choreographer and actress on Pose. And something I was very interested to learn was that it really required, as you mentioned earlier with us, extra research about how voguing would have been 30 years ago, because people don't understand that it's really changed. You know, what was emphasized was really changed. Do you have favorite discoveries from learning about 80s voguing?
The thing about performance back in the 80s is that it was more about old way. That's the category that they first started with. And old way was more so inspired by martial arts. It was inspired by poses in the Vogue magazines. It made my education even stronger. And it's like, it's a lot of research. It's so much that goes on in the ballroom.
Mm-hmm. How do you even go about digging into the culture of old voguing and old ballroom? You know, like, was it a lot of talking to people who were still around, who were in there? Are there like archival footages of things for you to watch of past ballrooms?
Mm-hmm. Well, still to this day, they have the category old way. So there are still people who have been legends and icons for like maybe 20 years ago, mm-hmm. who still compete. I've been a part of ballroom for a long time, so I have seen old way throughout ballroom. Mm-hmm. The difference was learning that style. Mm-hmm. I taught myself the style just so I can be able to teach it to someone else. As an artist, I learned to appreciate old way. Whereas when I first came into the ballroom scene, I'm like, what is that? We don't want to do that. And I'm like over here, Vogue in 3D, going off, fast mm-hmm. forward. So it made me appreciate where voguing started, and it made me even fall in love more with old way itself. So teaching it to people and seeing, because as a teacher, I teach voguing, so seeing people learning Vogue Femme, it's so beautiful. But to see someone learn old way, it's powerful. It's a different lane.
Well, speaking of when you were first getting into voguing, getting into ballroom, what years was that around, and what would you say was it was like then as opposed to how it's like now, and how did that interest start for you?
When I came into the ballroom scene, it was around 2003. Mm-hmm. That's when I walked my first ball, but I got chopped. So then I left for like a whole year. I left for like a whole year. And when I came back, I already had started my transition then. So I was able to introduce Laomi, and it was the same ball because it was the annual ball. So when I walked in the year after, I won my first trophy. Mm. The style difference between what I brought into the ballroom community and what was out then, it was that back then it was more about more femininity. It was more about hair, like hair flips, and more breaking the wrist and actually taking time to tell your story with your body. Mm-hmm. And as opposed to how I started voguing, it was more so an emotion. And it was something that they were not used to. There are two different styles of Vogue Femme. It's Vogue Femme, soft and feminine. And then there's dramatics. I was more so on the dramatic side, but it was so different. Back in the days when they did dramatic, it was more so showing rage in a sense, but in a controlled manner. But I didn't know that. I didn't know control. So my thing was very wild. I was just out there. I was a tornado out there just destroying stuff. But little by little, you know, I taught myself control, and I'm able to do the things that I'm able to do now.
This show is just incredibly addictive. My thing about Legendary is, what is it like to go from having no shows about voguing to having what looks to me like an incredibly expensive production that, you know, that looks, it's like Rockettes level lighting and spectacle every single week? Is it ever overwhelming just how crazy every episode looks?
I mean, I'm a part of ballroom, and if you have been going to balls, as long as I have been going to balls, the only thing different is the production, honestly, because the energy and the aesthetic of ballroom is always going to be there. I feel like the most intriguing thing about the show overall is the fact that these people are giving the ballroom scene the proper tools to create the productions that they've always wanted to create. If you ever do research on ballroom, there has been so many beautiful moments, beautiful productions put together by us in times where we didn't really have the right tools. So being given the right tools now, that's why you see what you see. A lot of it, it's, you know, they're providing the production, but the ballroom people themselves and the competitors are providing what they want to produce. So that's what's important. They're putting together their own productions. They're putting together their music down to their wardrobe. It's all that. And that's like authentic. You can't get that anywhere. And that's why every episode is so different. And you're going to be rooting for one house one week and then feel like a traitor the next week, because you might be like, wow, I like this.
I am definitely always Team Len Van. But then it's
I live for them.
But you know, I do want to ask too about the show. Where does the audience come from? Because the audience, like at point, seems like they at least are familiar with ballroom. Like some of them look like they are maybe friends and like family or members of the houses watching the people that they know compete, or were they purely just people brought in by HBO?
No, the crazy thing is that this is why I'm so thankful for Scout Productions and HBO Max. Not only did they want to put, you know, put a spotlight on the ballroom scene, but they wanted to do it in the most authentic way. And they have been doing that from the beginning, from the writers to, you know, the people who are working behind the sets and all of that, the people from hair and makeup, all of that. The people that are in the audience, they are a part of the community. They are a part of the ballroom scene. So you get to see the real authentic energy in the building. And that's something that's beautiful. You would have never thought that, you know, Scout Production and HBO will go that far to make sure that everyone's included.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I'm always interested in asking the people who come on the podcast, because the world has changed so much and, you know, how do we do the things that we love? What is day-to-day like for you? How are you getting to express yourself in a way that is reminiscent of ballroom or dancing now?
Well, inspiring the world, honestly. Yeah. Just being myself, inspiring, sharing my story, being visible, showing people that I'm human first. That's something that's important. A lot of people, they see you on these platforms, they see you doing these things, and they forget that you're human first. And that's something that I make sure that, you know, my followers and everybody who looks up to me, they know that. I want them to get to know me. That's something that, for me, it's important. You can love my artistry, that's amazing. But when you get to know me and you get to know my story and you get to know why I am where I am now, That's the beauty of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that ballroom has taught me always, is to stay true to myself.
I have a question just about the competitors on Legendary. So have you seen a lot of these people perform like over the years, like tons and tons of times? I'm sure there's some new talent in there too.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you have a longstanding background with a few of these people.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. I got to see some people that I've seen in the ballroom scene for a long time, people that I've known personally. There were people on the show who I've taught. You know, there are people and the show who I battled. So there was so many different. And of course, there was a lot of new talent. And for me, it was more so about seeing the growth and seeing what these houses can create and how they choose to incorporate whatever the house stands for into their performances and their productions.
Mm-hmm. What does the future look like for you in terms of what you think ballroom can do, where it should go? You know, I mean, this show is on now and we see some houses, and I'm sure there are plenty of other houses who would love to be on in future seasons. But do you see people watching this show like across America being like, I want to form my own house. I want to find ballroom in my city.
The crazy thing is that it has already happened. Mm-hmm. That's been going on for so long, ever since America's Best Dance Crew, honestly, a lot of that stuff has been happening. I've been fortunate to have been traveling. I've been traveling a lot overseas, internationally, like everywhere, where I've watched so many communities, so many Boron communities be created, so many houses be created, even new houses. Because, mm-hmm. you know, nowadays overseas, they have people who have created their own house. It's not even, it doesn't even have no even attachment to the U.S. Mm-hmm. Boron scene when it comes to, you know, the longevity and the iconic houses and the legendary houses. And that's something that it's never going to change. I feel like people are going to always be inspired. The thing about this show specifically is that you get to see how much hard work it takes and how real it gets. A lot of times, you know, these shows, they like to edit things and they try to make it TV and they try to make it good for TV. When it comes to the ballroom scene and when it comes to all these different stories of all these different individuals, it's so diverse that there's no way to water it down. No matter who's going to tell their story, you're going to inspire somebody in the world.
Mm-hmm. It is crazy how many stories you get just per episode. Like mm-hmm. you learn so much about like different types of experiences to have. And also, I've talked before about how Project Runway was an underrated reality show and it gave you like 7 queer people in a season. Mm-hmm. On this show, you are getting dozens. And also, for example, they are all hilarious in their own ways for the most part. It is even like the diversity of humor alone is crazy. Mm-hmm. Do you have favorite personalities on this show besides, you know, your own, which is explosive?
Honestly, I love ballroom overall. So honestly, every single person being given that moment to shine and to give off their personality to me, I love it. I didn't have a favorite because I know some of these people and some of the people are new. What I love is how raw, I live for the rawness of it, like the shadiness, mm-hmm. the little side marks that the girls is given, like all of that. That's my favorite part because that's ballroom. Like you would think that these people are enemies because of how thick the shade that they throw to each other on the floor. But as soon as they get off the floor, they're girlfriends. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're like, sis, you know? And that, to me, it shows ballroom. Mm-hmm. And there's no other way to put it. It goes to show how ballroom really is. You're going to get people that are funny. You're going to get people that's going to make you cry. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to be inspired. You might be turned off. You know, there's people on the show that you're like, But that's ballroom for you.
I feel like that has always been just, you know, really just like a paramount of, you know, like Black and like Latinx, like just queer culture, you know, like the idea that we can throw shade, you know, and like it's still love afterwards. And, you know, it's nice introducing people to the idea that you can have fun with it, you know? I mean, I wish like a show like American Idol or something had people being able to throw the shade that they want to throw at a singer, being like, she didn't hit that note, you know, and still loving each other at the end. So it feels real. Mm-hmm. Thank you for so many years just educating us on ballroom and Vogue and continuing to put yourself out there. And thank you so much for being on this show. I mean, we're all such huge fans of you.
Truly an icon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Coming up next, Keep It. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. What are we keeping this week, y'all?
Mine is a small one, so I'll go first, but it has a video homework requirement. So you guys, once I'm done complaining, you're going to have to go watch this video of Marseille Martin schooling everyone and sneezing into a $100 bill. This little girl is hilarious. I want to remind you she's 15 years old, but my Keep It this week goes to everyone who's been trolling Marseille Martin. There's very few people in this world that I think I would kill for, even fewer children. But if I catch any one of you fixing your greasy, greasy little fingers to tweet anything negative about Marseille Martin, our little Black girl messiah, I will literally have you gutted. I don't care. I love this girl so much. There's so much talent oozing from her, so much spirit. No one's allowed to touch her. Stop making fun of her. They made fun of her wig. They made fun of her wig that she wore for the BET Awards that she had photographed herself in, and they were calling her grandma and just dragging this little girl. Granted, the wig looked a little grandma-y, but let this girl figure out what she likes to wear and how she looks and leave her alone. Leave Marseille alone.
I will say, if you like become a star at age 13 or 14 or 15 nowadays,
or
you
8 are, like Marseille did. Yeah.
Right. You are subject to haters. And I
Think of yourself as like an adult. That happened to me maybe when I was 23, you know? Yeah. To be a child and have to deal with that, I definitely did not have the coping mechanisms for that. I never have thought about that. Like, there's no such thing as being a child star without hearing the worst people on earth talking about you.
Yeah, so, truly. It does go hand in hand.
I mean, convincing a walls.
That's what I'm saying. No, you know, right.
Remember the Onion article that referred to her as a cunt?
Oh, my goodness.
And then the reason black women will never get off Chrissy Teigen's neck because she said that Kavenzine was cocky.
I did not know that. I don't think I've ever heard that.
I'm just happy I wasn't around and cognizant when Drew Barrymore was getting the grunt of the hatred from media, because I don't think I would have been able to stand for that either.
Well, to be fair, she was on a lot of coke then, so she probably didn't know.
They're saying, what about me?
What is this video specifically, though? Like, what was Marseille doing? She sneezed into a $100 bill?
So Marseille takes her little camera out, and these kids know too much. She takes her camera out, and she goes, like, I'm so sorry that my wig wasn't up to par. And she makes a big show of it and acts very dramatic. And then at the very end, she sneezes into a $100 bill and goes, justice for Breonna Taylor. Bye.
Why is she sneezing into a $100 bill?
Because she wants to remind us of the wealth that she has accrued.
Capitalism.
You see.
Capitalism. No Name would not be happy with
okay,
that.
Okay, No Name.
She would not be happy with that.
Okay, girl.
In our HBO special, didn't you have a keep it where you're like, you were like, keep it to J. Cole for against No Name?
My keep it was to J. Cole for the No Name and J. Cole situation, but that was at a different stage of the situation. And maybe now it's Cole World over here. Maybe it's Cole World over here.
I mean, for those of you who don't know, he put out a song criticizing her tone for offering him books to read, you know, about capitalism, carceral punishment, etc.
Mm-hmm. The basics, truly.
And then she responded with a song, song 33, that was, you know, dragging him. And then she apologized for it later because she didn't mean to distract from the moment, right?
Yes, and that's what my keep it was, too. My keep it was to black women rescinding anything. Just let it be out there. It's hip-hop beef. Let it happen.
Lo and behold, Miss No Name, who did not want to distract from the moment, now cannot stop tweeting about Beyonce and how black buying power is the same as capitalism, which, yes. And this, here's my thing. There are a lot of conversations we all need to be having right now as black people.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of new things that we need to be learning about abolishing prisons, you know, defunding police departments, and capitalism in general, and how you know, black buying power within capitalism can be just as detrimental to our communities. But if you are just like gonna constantly just be like tweeting about Beyonce and then like screenshotting tweets about Beyonce and putting them on your Instagram too, it seems like you're less interested in having a conversation and you're more fixated on making the Beyonce hatred a thing. And it seems a little transparent because talking about Beyonce is an easy way to trend.
100%.
True.
Beyonce is not the only black person engaging in capitalism and black buying power.
Please, yeah, move this criticism over to Ira. It's more comfortable for me. I want to see it.
Move
I am
it over.
Amused by it.
Drag or me.
No Name, a Chicago artist who has worked very intimately with Chance the Rapper, is just totally chill with him dancing in Starburst commercials. Like, just talk about what's around you, even. And that kind of proves to me that you care at all about the situation.
And let's not forget the tweet that she sent out once that was saying, not just white hipsters come to my show, you know, like black people shouldn't blame like not having money or, you know, like black death of like not being able to come see my shows. Like they go see Megan Thee Stallion and et cetera. And it's like, it really just seems like you want to be popular then.
Also, girl, maybe Meg's more entertaining. I'm just going to put that out there. It's a little thing. And also, another thing that's another critique of Beyonce, and then I'll stop with all my little keep-its. Beyonce, the critique of Beyonce's pricing for her tickets, for her shows. It's like, No Name, if you want black kids to come to your shows, make your tickets cheaper. That also is a situation. Like, the same critique that you have, you can apply to yourself instead of just going, I'm throwing my hands up and I'm quitting rap, which she has done before. Mm-hmm.
And listen, I'm not saying Beyonce is beyond reproach, and I'm also not dragging No Name. I definitely appreciate the passion in this moment and getting people to read books and learn more in this era right now. But I also think that there's a difference between reading and educating people and just, like, I don't know, having a bone to pick.
Yeah, yeah. That being said, stream song 33. It's still really good.
It is a bop, actually.
It's amazing.
Maybe Megan should do a remix.
Stop it.
She can hop on the remix. Lewis, what's your keep it?
My keep it is for niche musical gay Twitter, but it's also to the album itself. You're going to be surprised I'm about to say this. My keep it is to the Jessie Ware album, What's Your Pleasure? You will remember weeks ago, I told you to listen to Spotlight by Jessie Ware, which is a great kind of lush, somewhat danceable song, a sexual song, a sexual emotional song.
Okay, Pitchfork.
The entire album, yes. Well, let me say something. She used to be the domain of basically Pitchfork. Like, that's how you found out about Jessie Ware. And now, like, gay people, gay men, are finding her more and more. And I'm happy about that. The music is good. But, like every other fucking album that came out this summer for us, this is being touted as a disco revival. Now, let me say something. Chromatica actually kind of was that. The Dua Lipa album was that. This, to me, is a slightly sped up Sade album, and I am sorry, I am put to sleep by this album. It does not make you fucking move.
I did not expect to hear this from you. I thought that you were going to come here literally with
screaming,
like half open bottles of poppers talking about this album.
We're all junkies in our own way. Leave
them
alone.
I'm an R&B junkie.
The problem is for this album, it's just not danceable enough. To me, it reminds me less of a disco and more like an expensive hotel lobby, which we need those too. I like having like a lightly throbbing beat as I wait for my friend to descend from the elevator or whatever. But just, can you truly dance to this album? I think you're lying. I think you're lying.
You can't dance to Save a Kiss. Like, kind step into of? My life, read my lips.
Is the keep it for the album or for the genre that the album was deemed? I'm very lost.
I think it's not what people are saying it is, and I think the album is slightly worse than people are saying it is.
Oh, no. I think this album is very good. And what I would say is that I thought people were overhyping it at first because, you know, the gays were just discovering Miss Jessie Ware, and you called it Pitchfork era, like, coming from like the Midwest and like Chicago, like I have friends in the Pitchfork realm who are constantly talking about Jessie Ware when she first came out,
shoving them down our throats.
And I was like, you gotta listen to Jessie Ware. I was like, if you don't chill, Jessie Ware, Katy B. I was like, chill. I'm mostly talking about my friend Oliver Sava, but I like the album, you know?
Did you hear how you said you like the album?
I do.
Can you bring it to love, though? Maybe not.
Well, it's not at love yet because, to be honest, I'm still listening to the Chloe and Halle album, you know? Like, I only recently started getting into the new Kalani album and also Teyana Taylor's The Album, which I think is great, even though it's too damn long. So Jessie Ware, I had a very emotional sort of like out of body experience to it, like the first two spins I gave to it, but I haven't truly been able to sit with the album in a way that I would want to. But I don't know, it felt very, you know, light Donna to me, you know, light Diana, maybe not Donna. Donna is pure disco.
Who's craving light Donna? Like, why can't we just actually dance? Why can't it just be unpretentious bops as opposed to, like...
The movie High Note is light Donna.
True. Oh, is that what you thought I wanted more of?
A colder, slower Donna. Donna Winter.
Yeah. Yes. Wow, Donna Winter. Gets. Yes. Yeah. It's close. It's close. Yeah, it's like she has like kind of a Kate Bush vibe too, where it's mostly about, it's more about atmosphere than about the throb of the music. So anyway,
how about this, Lewis? Put the album down. Don't listen to it. How about that?
I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying, hey, gays, let's also have a conversation about what it is.
Yeah. Also, baby, there is hardly any disco on Future Nostalgia.
But like,
Future Nostalgia is like '80s dance pop. And my whole thing about when people were talking
dance
about
dance floor disco, fillers, fine. I won't call that disco.
When people were talking about the disco revival and kept talking about Miss Dua Lipa, I was like, she does not sing disco. Well, disco, you need, you know, like, I'm a disco hearer, you know? I like songs of sweet melodies and of meaning. But
that was a Whitney Houston meme that he reappropriated for his own purposes in case anybody doesn't understand, okay?
They know that's what I do. I would offer that the disco-iest song on Future Nostalgia is Cool, produced by Stuart Price, and he has produced better disco-sounding songs for Kylie and Madonna, like people who could actually do disco. That's why I think the best songs on Future Nostalgia are the song Physical and the title track.
You know, I'm a defender of that. I love the part of that song that sounds like pop music by M, the song pop music.
Yeah.
You know, if you can get with this. Yeah.
You know, it's that very Olivia Newton-John, poppy, danceable 80s vibe, but not disco.
Very well. Okay, Ira, we have like 6 seconds. What are you keeping?
My keep it is to yet another blackface fiasco. Only this time.
Keep them coming.
I want the blackface back, okay? Get the blackface on my TV. I am watching that. Hulu removed an episode of The Golden Girls with a blackface scene in it. Now, to set the scene for you all, this episode is season 3. It's called Mixed Blessings. And in the episode, Dorothy's son, Michael, plans to wed a much older black woman named Lorraine, played by Rosalind Cash. And Dorothy's critical of the age difference, and Lorraine's family disapproves of their daughter marrying a white man, so the two families attempt to stop the marriage. But when Lorraine's family arrives, Rose and Blanche are testing out a new mud face treatment, and they greet the family with their masks still on, and they're like, this is mud on our faces. We're not really black. And I'm sorry, that's comedy.
Hilarious!
And my complaint about this is obviously the move of some reactionary white person at Hulu who's seeing the Tina Fey blackface moment, seeing the Community blackface moment, seeing God at this point, like episodes of Barney probably have blackface in them. It's just seeing this and being like, we need to remove this. People are going to be mad about this. And this shows not only a lack of understanding about what people are mad about, it also just shows that like this person either didn't really watch the episode or they're just dumb. You know, watch it and they're dumb. And
I was gonna say what they saw was a gif of this episode.
Yeah.
And immediately thought the worst. Like, oh, we caught them in the middle of some blackface routine.
Right.
As opposed to
And the thing is, this isn't blackface. You have to be able to look at intent, and you also just have to not be a fucking idiot. I mean, there's nothing about this that is blackface. And honestly, the removal of the episode from Hulu is embarrassing because what black people actually want is for you to fucking hire us, okay? Put us in writers' rooms and maybe then we can make better jokes about race and dismantle the white supremacist power structures in Hollywood. We don't need you removing episodes of Golden Girls that aren't actually blackface. Like, it's just dumb, you know?
Also, it's an episode that handles racism in such a, like, a unique and multifaceted way. And Golden Girls is a show that black people fucking love. Absolutely love. Most people I know who watch Golden Girls are just my black gay friends. So it's annoying when they're clearing, like, what this does, like you were saying, Ira, is just an unhelpful concession that like loses steam on what we're trying to do, what we're trying to say. It just trivializes everything.
It does, especially when the Ankler just put out a piece on June 12th that takes a peek into Hollywood diversity circa 2020. And it basically looks at the corporate structures of the studios and networks that make our shows, right? And it's like Disney Corporate, Disney Studios, Disney TV, Warner Media, Comcast, NBC Universal, Viacom. It's like Sony. The only diversity is a diversity of people named Alan. You know, it is white men largely named Alan, other white men, white women, couple Asians, you know, and like maybe one or two black women in publicity at some networks, yeah. You know, but like it is just pointing out the fact that the way to fix shit like this is we need to be talking about the real power structures in Hollywood. And that's not just people writing the shows. That is people who are able to greenlight shows. Those are people who are deciding whether or not black content is relatable on TV, you know? And mm-hmm. if your executive suite is all white men, they're not going to be producing content that is good for black people, for queer people, for women, for trans people, for anyone, you know? And it's constantly yeah. counting on the benevolence of rich white moderates to maybe do us a solid. And that's really not going to get us anywhere. Mm-hmm.
I think we can agree I'm a Blanche, right? Maybe some Sophia. Maybe some Sophia.
Yeah. I could say you're a Blanche. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very bothered. Yes. All four of them Emmy winners, of course.
Although I will say that you have a bit of Dorothy in you.
I'm Dorothy.
Oh, no. What am I saying? Of course I have some yeah. Dorothy in me.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Sometimes
definitely.
You can get a little angry.
The stern. It's the stern in you.
The language of my forehead and neck alone. That's some Zbornak-gurry.
Don't interrupt Lewis's tea time. He will bite your head off. Anyway, that's our show this week. Thank you to Adam Rippon and Laomi for joining us. We'll see you next time for more Keep It. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seguin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.